Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Been kept at home. Our goal was to end that.
It's the 50th anniversary of the law that created special education as we know it. We take stock of where things stand now and look to the future.
For Wednesday, December 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, a look at the Pentagon press corps, now filled with members handpicked by the Trump administration.
I'm concerned that there is so much damage being done by Pete Hegseth.
And the president says he wants Somalis in the U.S. to leave.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Okay? Somebody said, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country is no good for a reason. Their country stinks.
We hear from Minnesota, home to the country's largest Somali community.
And the latest in our Here to Help series, First This News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Pentagon's Inspector General concluded that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth could have put U.S. troops in harm's way by sharing information over Signal in March about a pending U.S. airstrikes in Yemen. NPR's Deirdre Walsh has more.
A classified IG report delivered to Capitol Hill found that Secretary Hegseth risked potential compromise of information that could have endangered the safety of U.S. personnel on the mission by using the messaging app Signal. That's according to a source briefed on the report who was not authorized to speak publicly. If intercepted by a foreign adversary, it could have led to harm. Hegseth did not agree to an interview with investigators, but submitted written responses. He noted he has the authority to declassify material, but there was no indication he did before he shared it. An unredacted version of the report is expected to be released on Thursday. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
We should note Catherine Marr, the CEO of NPR, chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. President Trump is rolling back Biden-era fuel economy standards for the auto industry.
We're officially terminating Joe Biden's ridiculously burdensome, horrible, actually, CAFE standards that imposed expensive restrictions and all sorts of problems, gave all sorts of problems to automakers.
Under the Biden administration, car makers were required to increase fuel efficiency of passenger vehicles and light trucks to about 50 miles per gallon by 2031. That would also encourage electric vehicle sales. Reuters reported that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration proposed reducing the requirements from 2022 to 2031 model years to around 34 miles to the gallon. President Trump has pardoned Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar and his wife in a federal bribery and conspiracy case. On social media, Trump alleged that the couple was prosecuted because of the representative's criticism of former President Biden's immigration policies. New Orleans is the latest target of the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. Mel Bridges with member station WWNO reports Customs and Border Patrol officers are arriving in the city.
The Department of Homeland Security says it's sending federal agents to address, quote, criminal illegal aliens roaming free, and says local authorities are not cooperating with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office is under a federal consent decree which prohibits them from holding people suspected of being in the country illegally beyond their release date. The FBI and Louisiana State Police have rolled out a joint effort to prevent citizens from interfering with federal immigration officers. Other Democratic-led cities like Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Charlotte have also seen major immigration enforcement efforts. For NPR News, I'm Mel Bridges.
U.S. stocks have ended the day higher, with the Dow closing up more than 400 points. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Santa Clara and San Francisco counties are joining a lawsuit filed this week against the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. That's after the Trump administration announced a shift away from funding permanent housing for the formerly homeless. KQED's Aaron Baldessari reports.
Bay Area advocacy groups say around $100 million could be lost due to the changes. Historically, the vast majority of funding has gone to permanent housing. But under the new guidelines, the department will prioritize clearing encampments and temporary housing. The suit says the abrupt about course came too late in the year after a statutory deadline had passed. and that the new policies conflict with other federal laws. HUD did not immediately respond. I'm Erin Baldessari, KQED News.
California has launched a new online tool to track unlawful conduct by federal agents using civilian reports. State Attorney General Rob Bonta says the portal is a necessary response to reports of unmarked vehicles and abduction-style arrests that have many residents living in fear.
When Californians witness conduct that looks unlawful, excessive force, unnecessary detentions, unconstitutional searches, they deserve a place to report it. A place where their information is taken seriously. This portal helps us do just that.
Residents can upload photos, videos, and information as evidence of misconduct. The Attorney General's office said it can't provide legal advice or represent individuals who submit complaints, but will use the data to track patterns and for potential legal action. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Lindley and a new season of Karen Peary, streaming at BritBox.com, and the listeners of KQED. Support for KQED comes from Oakland Ballet, presenting Bram Lustig's The Nutcracker December 20th and 21st, a beloved holiday tradition and magical holiday experience in Oakland's iconic Paramount Theater. Tickets at oaklandballet.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 50 years ago, just after Thanksgiving 1975, President Gerald Ford signed a landmark law that created special education as we know it. Well, for the next few minutes, we're going to mark its 50th anniversary by taking stock of where things stand today, as the Trump administration has tried to make significant cuts to federal staff who support and protect students with disabilities. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner joins us now. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Elsa.
So can we just first talk about what things were even like for students with disabilities before this landmark law even came down?
In 1970, federal data shows that public schools educated just one in five children with a disability, Elsa. I spoke with Ed Martin. He's now 94, and he helped write that landmark law that changed that.
Mostly, it was just that they were invisible. They had been kept at home. Our goal was to end that.
So before the law passed, Martin helped organize public hearings for parents so they could share their stories directly with lawmakers.
There was one mother who told us a story about the school bus stopping at the foot of her driveway and her daughter standing in the window crying, saying, "Why can't I go with the other kids?"
Ultimately, Elsa, Congress listened. They passed what we now know as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. Mm-hmm. And the very next school year, it helped some 3.7 million students.
Wow. Okay, and what does it mean that this law helped all of those millions of students? Like, what changed for them precisely?
Yeah, the law guarantees children with disabilities the right to a free, appropriate public education. That means schools have to provide accommodations. They're also required to keep kids in traditional classrooms as much as possible. To help pay for it, Congress sends states billions of dollars every year. And then finally, the Education Department provides oversight through its Office of Special Education Programs, which fields calls from families, and it makes sure states follow the law.
And what if parents worry that a school is falling short, or even worse, actually discriminating against their child?
They can file a disability discrimination complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, or OCR. Now, its authority does not come from IDEA, but there tends to be a lot of overlap. And if OCR sees something concerning about how a child has been treated at school, its attorneys can open an investigation, and there's no need for a family to hire an expensive lawyer or advocate.
Well, as we said, we know that the Trump administration has made deep cuts across the Education Department. How might those cuts affect the federal role in special education, you think?
Yeah, in several ways. The Office for Civil Rights lost about half its staff in spring layoffs. And then during the shutdown, the administration fired most of those who were left. They also fired nearly everyone at the Office for Special Education. Now, those shutdown cuts, Elsa, have since been reversed, but there's no guarantee the administration won't try to make them again. President Trump has also said he wants to move special education to a different agency. In defending all of this, Education Secretary Linda McMahon has said she does not want to cut special education funding. Instead, what she wants to cut is, quote, the centralized bureaucracy micromanaging what should be a state-led responsibility, she says.
Well, Corey, you said the Office for Civil Rights now has about half the staff it had in January, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean for parents filing disability discrimination complaints then?
To answer that question, Elsa, I want to introduce you very quickly to one family I met. They live in a Kansas City suburb, Maggie Heilman and her daughter Brooklyn, who's in eighth grade. Brooklyn has Down syndrome, which also affects her speech. She loves playing basketball, she told me, also dancing. She and her mom talked about how Brooklyn's favorite hot lunch at school is chicken nuggets with mashed potatoes.
Yum.
After mold, suckers, and
you go get seconds? Oh my, I knew you got seconds.
Doesn't it? Get more mashed potatoes.
You like to dip the mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
I do too.
Now, in October 2023, Maggie Heilman told me she got a call from Brooklyn School that her daughter had become agitated and was secluded for 20 minutes in a small padded room. Now, schools sometimes turn to seclusion when a student poses a risk to themselves or others. It is allowed in many states, but it can also be traumatic. And Heilman says she told school staff that she opposed the use of seclusion with Brooklyn. After that, she says the school used a kind of informal seclusion.
And we just saw our daughter's health physically, mentally, emotionally deteriorate.
And then finally, Brooklyn switched schools and things immediately turned around for her. But Heilman says she worried for the students who came after her. So she filed a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, OCR, arguing that Brooklyn had been denied her legal right to a free, appropriate public education.
And what happened with that complaint?
Well, an attorney at OCR opened an investigation, we know that, just over a year ago. But since then, Heilman has had two different OCR attorneys who both appear to have gotten caught up in the administration's mass firings. Heilman hasn't heard anything new about her case in months. In a statement, the department told NPR, quote, we are rebuilding and refocusing OCR to enable the office to protect students and enforce the law. But Elsa, public data suggest OCR is shifting away from these kind of labor-intensive, disability-related investigations. Since Trump took office, it has reached resolution agreements in 73 disability cases. But compare that to the first year of Trump's first term in 2017. Instead of 73, OCR reached agreements in more than 1,000 such cases.
Wow, that's a huge difference. Well, considering how 50 years ago things were really hard for kids with disabilities, how does that compare with where things are now?
I mean, look, IDEA now reaches more than 8 million children, giving them educational opportunities that kids with disabilities simply did not have before this law existed.
Yeah.
And that is a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now we're just in a moment of change, or at least uncertainty. You know, the message from the Trump administration is the money that comes with IDEA should keep flowing to states, but that states can handle the rest without much federal oversight. And frankly, the last time families really had to rely solely on their states was before 1975, when this law was passed.
That is NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Thank you so much, Corey.
You're welcome, Elsa.
This week, the Pentagon unveiled its new press corps, mostly right-wing outlets handpicked by the Trump administration to cover the Trump administration. You may recall that back in October, established media organizations, including NPR, walked out after refusing to comply with new rules. For an update on who is asking questions at the Pentagon now, I want to bring in Steve Walsh, who covers the military for WHRO in Norfolk. Hey there, Steve.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Let's go back for a sec to the origins of all this. It was a pledge, and the Pentagon wanted all Pentagon reporters to sign it.
Right, right. So the vast majority of outlets from Fox News to the New York Times to NPR refused to sign a pledge that basically said they would not report on anything that was not officially authorized by the Department of Defense, which this administration now calls the Department of War. Shortly after that happened, the Pentagon announced a new group of mainly right-wing outlets, which they say replaces the traditional press corps. These include bloggers and talk show hosts, many of whom have never covered the Defense Department, and many of them were actually asked by the Pentagon to become members of this new press corps. The group that showed up this week included former Congressman Matt Gaetz, who had briefly been President Trump's nominee for Attorney General. He now has a show on the One America News Network, and Laura Loomer, who is a conservative activist with deep ties to the White House.
Now, the Pentagon has not held very many on-camera briefings with reporters, not since Trump took office again back in January. This week, that changed. Tell me more.
Yeah. So starting Monday, they have been getting an orientation. Many of these people don't live in Washington. The media area has been largely vacant since the walkout in October. They've posted videos on social media from the Pentagon briefing room, which had been off limits to the press corps for months. Yesterday, Deputy Press Secretary Kingsley Wilson gave her first on-air, on-camera briefing since becoming coming on board in January. Wilson herself has been accused of previously making anti-Semitic posts before she was brought into the Pentagon. She spent a fair amount of time railing against the mainstream media. Now, the questions were a mixed bag. One outlet did ask about when the Pentagon would produce the intelligence to justify the lethal strikes against the boats in the Caribbean. Others adopted the taunt seditious six that Secretary Hegseth uses to describe the group of Democratic lawmakers who urged troops not to follow unlawful orders. I spoke with the last deputy Pentagon press secretary under the Biden administration, Sabrina Singh. She worries that this new group is part of a larger politicization of the military.
I'm concerned that there is so much damage being done by Pete Hegseth. There will one day be another Secretary of Defense. Whoever that person is going to have to contend with the fact that we have so deeply politicized service members, and I don't know how you undo that damage.
Well, and just practically speaking, Steve, how is all this changing how you, how other defense reporters are doing their jobs?
Well, I mean, as we know, the lack of access has not stopped the flow of stories coming out of the Pentagon. People are still talking, people are still working their sources, and they're still doing their job. Several outlets did ask for access to the press conference, but they were denied, so it doesn't look like people are going to be getting in the building on a regular basis. We're told the new group met today with Secretary Hegseth, who has only given two on-camera briefings himself at the Pentagon.
And who is very much in the hot seat for all kinds of things right now. WHRO's mm-hmm. Steve Walsh, thanks very much for your reporting.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Landmark College, commemorating 40 years of educating people who learn differently, with programs on campus and online for both students and professionals. Learn more at landmark.edu.
Did you miss Giving Newsday? I'm Carly Severin, Senior Editor of Audience News. You can still get your gift matched. The deadline has been extended, and all gifts up to $20,000 will be doubled until midnight tonight. Help KQED turn up the volume by donating now at kqed.org/donate.
I'm Jeff Bennett on the next NewsHour. How the Trump administration is expanding the use of the Border Patrol to enforce its immigration crackdown. That's Wednesday on the PBS NewsHour.
Catch the story, the latest news, some news developing right now. So stay informed on the PBS NewsHour at 3 p.m.
We, the planet that is, has a plastics problem.
It's not because we're not all trying. It's because by design,
most plastics are not recyclable.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How we got here and where we might be going. Next time on Marketplace.
4 o'clock today and 6:30 p.m. Every new year, many of us make resolutions and many of them never quite happen. Are you someone who does that? Do you think next year will be different? If so, tell us why. What do you plan to do differently in the new year? Share your story with KQED's Perspectives. Visit KQED.org/perspectives to submit your piece today. We hope to hear from you. Support for NPR this afternoon comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, in movie theaters starting December 5th. Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org. And the listeners of KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. About 80,000 people of Somali descent now call Minnesota their home. Almost all of them are U.S. citizens. And yesterday, President Trump attacked Somali immigrants in racist and xenophobic terms.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country is no good for a reason. Their country stinks.
The mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul spoke up to defend their Somali community. They also responded to reports that the Trump administration is targeting that community with extra immigration enforcement. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio joins us now with more from St. Paul. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
So what seems to have prompted Trump's statements there?
Well, let me say first that Trump and Minnesota's governor, Tim Walz, have been at odds since last year when the governor was former Vice President Kamala Harris's running mate on the Democratic right. presidential ticket. At a cabinet meeting yesterday, the president attacked the Somali American community here in response to a question about widespread fraud in Minnesota's social service programs during the Walz administration. And here is some context. Since late 2022, federal prosecutors here have charged 78 people connected to a nonprofit called Feeding Our Future with stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from taxpayer-funded child nutrition programs. The convicted ringleader, Amy Bach, is white, but the majority of the defendants in this case are of Somali descent, and most are naturalized U.S. citizens. Trump went on to call Somali Americans, quote, garbage, including one of his fiercest critics, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. The Minneapolis Democrat responded, saying, quote, his obsession with me is creepy. And to be clear, neither Walz nor Omar have been implicated in the fraud investigation.
Well, Matt, as we mentioned, there have been several reports that the Trump administration is going to target undocumented Somali immigrants in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So what have city leaders said about that?
Well, they were quick to respond. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey denounced the president's comments and said that Somali immigrants have been a key part of the community's fabric for decades. Many are not immigrants. They're second-generation Americans who were born here. Frey said that immigration officials are at major risk of violating the community's constitutional rights.
When people are arrested by federal immigration agents, they're going to get the wrong people. They're going to screw it up so badly that they're not just violating habeas corpus, but they are taking away the rights of American citizens.
Now, Mayor Melvin Carter of St. Paul was with Frey yesterday at a news conference and echoed those comments.
Who he just attacked isn't just Somalis. Who he attacked is Somali Americans. Who he attacked is Americans.
And what about leaders in the Somali community? Like, what kind of responses are you hearing from them to all of this?
Jelani Hussein, who leads the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations and was born in Somalia, came here as a child, said today that the community has reported already seeing an increased presence of immigration and customs enforcement personnel in the Twin Cities. He also said he's received reports of American citizens being asked about their citizenship. Hussein says this is blatantly discriminatory.
Weaponizing ICE to target black Somali immigrants. This is not immigration policy. This is racism being directed from the president's office.
Hmm. Well, when it comes to local law enforcement, Matt, did police say how they will respond if there is an uptick in immigration enforcement there?
Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara says his department does not enforce federal immigration law, but he did say if there are demonstrations that become violent, police are required to respond to protect public safety.
That is Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik. Thank you so much, Matt.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on this program, we'll take a look at the Border Patrol's aggressive immigration operation in Charlotte, North Carolina. The week-long operation took the city by surprise, and immigrants and other residents say that their city will never be the same. The economic costs are still rippling out throughout the city. Meanwhile, the immigration crackdown has caused an outpouring of solidarity among the residents. Hear more tomorrow on All Things Considered.
Immediately after Hurricane Helene flooded western North Carolina in September of last year, neighbors helped neighbors get supplies, operate generators, and reach safety. But many people wanted to do more. As part of our series on volunteerism, here to help, Zachary Turner from member station WFAE brings us this report on western North Carolina's first volunteer emergency response team.
After Helene, Black Mountain resident Chris Kepler sprung into action, using her chainsaw to clear debris.
One of my neighbor's tree fell down across her entire front yard. It blocked her in. She was on oxygen. And, of course, we didn't have power or anything. And I wasn't quite sure how I would get hold of first responders because the 911 system was down.
The town's emergency communications had failed, along with their backup radio system. As a former Marine, she felt she could help.
There were a lot of people that wanted to do more, but we weren't trained.
Other residents were in the same boat. They wanted to help, but couldn't. Many had skills that the town could have really used, like Wendy Coins.
As a newly retired family doctor, I felt like there wasn't any organized way for me to help.
You wanted to help, but
so
you just
I wanted to help, and it was really hard, and we had no set systems in place prior to the disaster for community members just to jump in.
So they decided to start the town's Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT. They spent the last several months training with first responders on disaster communications and preparedness. Now, 28 residents can help with evacuations, traffic control, supply distribution, and other tasks. They got their first assignment during a Halloween event. About 3,000 kids go door-to-door on two blocked-off streets near downtown. It's a big deal in a small mountain community of roughly 9,000. Kepler staffed one of two reunification tents.
We're assisting with lost kids, and so we can communicate between our team and by putting out a description of the child or the parent, if the parent got lost from the child.
Tonight, Kepler and her fellow CERT members get a good lesson on using their new emergency radios. Another volunteer radios Kepler.
What members will be in each group, please?
And Victor 215.
They're trying to use their Victor numbers, Victor for volunteer, instead of names.
Volunteer firefighter David Billstrom has been training the CERT members on the do's and don'ts of using these radios.
So you have to press the button to talk and hesitate for just a minute. The rule is half a second, and then start talking.
Halloween night was a certified success, according to Billstrom. The team reunited four kids with their parents and greatly improved their radio skills. And for Kepler, she feels more prepared.
I always wanted to know, was there more that I could have done? So this gives me the skills to hopefully continue to educate my neighbors, first and foremost, and my family, and make sure that we're ready, and then to be able to help the community at large.
In the meantime, Kepler and the other volunteers will keep training and refining their radio etiquette. For NPR News, I'm Zachary Turner in Black Mountain.
This is is NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus's Holiday Spectacular, a concert series across the Bay Area, blending festive classics with campy showstoppers from Elton, Gaga, and more. Info and tickets at sfgmc.org. Support for KQED's card donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com. Today at 2 on the World, an outbreak of African swine flu in Spain has prompted a lockdown in the region of Catalonia. Also today, a look at Jamaica's ongoing recovery efforts in the wake of the devastating Hurricane Melissa. Those global stories, many others on the way in 30 minutes on KQED News on the World. I'm Dave Freeman. Good afternoon on Wednesday, KQED News at 1:30.
All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Who doesn't love pasta? Well, Italian pasta could soon be missing from your store shelves or double in price due to President Trump's tariffs.
Our interpretation is that the short answer is politics and not economics.
That story's ahead after the summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump continues to use his executive powers to grant clemency to people charged or convicted for various federal crimes. Today, he pardoned a Democratic member of Congress along with his wife. Congressman Henry Cuellar and his wife Imelda were set to go on trial in April, facing federal bribery and corruption charges.
I want to thank President Trump for this action that he took. On behalf of my wife and my family, I want to say thank you. I think the facts have been very clear.
Prosecutors said the Texas Democrat and his wife accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars to further the interests of Azerbaijan Energy Company and a bank in Mexico. President Trump claims without evidence, though, that the prosecution was politically motivated and that the Biden administration was going after Cuellar for criticizing his border policies. Since July of this year, Trump has pardoned more than 1,600 people. Israel says it will soon open Gaza's border with Egypt, allowing Palestinians to leave for the first time in a year. But Egypt says it won't open the border until Palestinians can return. Here's NPR's Jerome Sokolovsky.
Rafah crossing has been closed since Israel took control of the border area in May 2024. Israel's government says the reopening is in line with the October ceasefire deal with Hamas. An official briefed on the matter, but not authorized to speak publicly, told NPR it was the result of a phone call on Tuesday between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Trump, who wants to see progress on the deal. Israel says the crossing will be opened only to one-way traffic out of Gaza, but Egypt controls the other side of the border, and its government says in a statement that the crossing will only open if passage is allowed in both directions. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to NPR. The Sri Lankan government says the death toll following catastrophic flooding and landslides has risen to more than 470 people on the island nation. As Sweta Desai reports from Mumbai, hundreds of people are still missing.
President Anura Kumara Desanyake declared a state of emergency even as authorities estimated that they need $7 billion to rebuild homes, roads, and infrastructure destroyed by the cyclone that battered Sri Lanka over the weekend. Local media report that hundreds of thousands of people remain displaced and some of the worst affected areas in Sri Lanka's central hills continue to be inaccessible. Extreme weather has also battered other parts of Asia, including in Indonesia, where more than 700 people have died amid heavy rainfall, landslides and flooding. Heavy rains are an annual event in South Asia, but climate change is making those downpours more erratic and extreme. For NPR News, I'm Shweta Desai in Mumbai.
The European Union has laid out a plan to fund Ukraine using frozen Russian assets over the next couple of years. Belgium, where most of those assets are being held, has rejected the reparations loan, citing financial and legal risks. The EU wants to provide 90 billion euros to cover two-thirds of Ukraine's financial needs as well as their military requirements. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from CalPrivacy, enforcing privacy regulations and protecting consumer rights. Californians can take control of their personal information by opting out of selling and sharing it with businesses. More information at privacy.ca.gov. Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Coming up on Spook this week, Ray hated being a paperboy for the hard route and rude customers, but there was one customer who was different from the rest, and Ray didn't understand why. That's on Spook, wherever you listen to podcasts. Support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters, everywhere December 5th. Capital One offering their premium level card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And by the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Israel has tested all kinds of new weaponry in the last 2 years of war. This week, it revealed some of that technology and other weapons it has created for future wars. Despite a global outcry over the huge civilian death toll in Gaza, Israel is selling the tech to other countries. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
A lot of the military tech on display this week at an expo at Tel Aviv University looked like something out of a sci-fi movie, like a new high-powered laser that looks like a huge camera lens.
This is the turret from our system called Iron Beam.
Ari Sasher from the Israeli arms manufacturer Rafael. Israel says it will begin to deploy the Iron Beam by the end of the month. The laser can knock rockets, mortars, and cruise missiles out of the sky.
It takes a very powerful beam of light. We heat the target, we deep fry it, and then the target blows up by itself.
When the Gaza war broke out following a Hamas attack 2 years ago, the military began using all kinds of new drones for surveillance and targeting. Daniel Almog's company, Eyes Atop, provides the Israeli military, the IDF, with handheld screens that soldiers use to coordinate multiple kinds of drones.
So that any new drone the IDF wants to introduce, the pilot can fly on day one like a Jedi.
A screen on display shows a recording of a flight over a Palestinian village in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Almog explains what the system can do.
You want to close the kill chain with a single operator. So through our orchestration system, you can call in a kamikaze drone or a heavy lift strike drone like this to drop munition on the target.
Israel also began using unmanned vehicles on the ground in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria, made by a company called Otopia. They roll into enemy territory, scan and identify targets using AI, and keep the soldier out of harm's way, says founder Amit Rosenzweig.
He or she can drink coffee while using a joystick to control a tank or an APC or whatever it is that he or she needs to control to get the job done.
Palestinians in Gaza have posted videos like this one when a person spots a military robot on wheels. And videos of armored personnel carriers laden with explosives. Again, Rosenzweig.
Some videos were published where you can see something like a large vehicle, APC, that's the purpose of such vehicle is, yes, to go somewhere and explode, not necessarily to take down a building, but maybe take down a bad guy.
Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians have been killed, has drawn worldwide criticism, including accusations of genocide, which Israel rejects. Outside the expo, about 30 Israeli university students and faculty protested. Anthropology professor Ofra Goldstein-Gidoni.
The drones, which seems to be very high-tech and great, but basically using AI, all this clever technology, many people were killed by drones. And the thing is that we are all complicit here in Israel.
To protest the war, some countries said they would restrict arms sales to Israel. But officials from more than 20 countries attended this Israeli Defense Expo, organizers say. Israeli Colonel Yishai Kohn says defense exports are soaring.
In general, Israel's export has been breaking its record for the past 3 years, each year in a row, and we expect that this year will end with a new record too.
Israel's Aero defense system, which countered Iranian missiles this year, was deployed today in Germany, which sees Russia as a growing threat and sees this tech as essential. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Italian pasta could vanish from the grocery store shelves or at least double in price starting in January. That is if the Commerce Department goes ahead with the decision to slap heavy duties on imports from over a dozen Italian pasta brands. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports on the ongoing negotiations.
Since the 1800s, Italian pasta, fusilli, spaghetti, rigatoni, has been shipped across the Atlantic to be enjoyed by Americans.
Questa non è semplicemente una pasta.
It's not just pasta, says one advert for the Italian La Molisana pasta brand.
È una dichiarazione d'amore, tutta italiana. La Molisana.
It's an all-Italian declaration of love. Under the Trump administration, though, this declaration is being well and truly spurned, and the fight for Italian pasta is now national news. Here's NBC's Today.
Americans could soon be saying arrivederci to their favorite Italian pastas. Imports from 13 Italian pasta brands, including favorites like Barilla and Rumo, are staring down a 107% tariff.
This whopping extra import cost is a combination of tariffs the White House placed on all goods coming from the European Union and a penalty of almost 92% imposed by the U.S. Department of Commerce on pasta brands accused of dumping practices. This is when a company sells goods abroad at a cheaper price than in its domestic market. American competitor pasta producers have long accused Italian pasta brands of doing this, triggering regular investigations by the Department of Commerce. But this time, the penalty is huge, and Italian pasta companies and economic experts don't understand why.
Our update analysis of Italian pasta trade shows no evidence of the pasta dumping behavior.
Chiara Donegani is a senior teaching fellow in economics at Aston University in the United Kingdom. She says Italian pasta trades on the idea of heritage and quality, and so sells at much higher prices than American pasta.
Pasta is an iconic product. The renowned, well-known element of the Mediterranean diet. This is not dumping. This is premium dining, we would say.
The U.S. Department of Commerce says it applied the penalty after two Italian pasta companies it contacted for review, Garofalo and La Molisana, didn't provide the full requested data, and the response included things like untranslated Italian words. The Commerce Department then decided to hit nearly a dozen other Italian pasta companies with the same punitive measures. Why is it doing this? The Department of Commerce didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. Donegani thinks.
Our interpretation is that the short answer is politics and not economics.
President Trump has been using tariffs as an economic weapon for many issues, from trying to bring manufacturing to the United States to applying political pressure on other countries. In Italy, the foreign ministry is now directly involved in the Italian pasta affair, and a special task force has been set up to handle it.
La situazione è quella di una trattativa in corso.
Lorenzo Bazzana from Coldiretti, Italy's trade association that protects Italian produce and food producers, explains negotiations are now underway. And the White House has said Italian pasta brands still have time to engage with a review before the duties are final. If the full duties were imposed, Bazzana says, it would be, of course, bad news for Italian pasta makers, for whom the US is the second largest export market. But they could find markets elsewhere.
Chi viene poi alla fine penalizzato è quel consumatore.
Who really loses out is the American consumer. The cost of their Italian pasta would skyrocket, or possibly, Bazzana says, they simply wouldn't be able to find it in shops anymore. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Some people spend their retirement playing golf. Others travel. In Philadelphia, the retirees and the Senior Environment Corps see themselves as watchdogs for the local environment. WHYY's Sophia Schmidt reports.
Bob Meyer is 71 years old. He retired from a career as a biology professor, but he still likes to keep busy.
The horrible lure of retirement is to do nothing. And, you know, that's no good because you just end up vegetating at home watching, you know, daytime TV, and I don't want to do that.
Instead, Meyer volunteers with the Senior Environment Corps in Northwest Philadelphia. The group of more than a dozen retirees take on projects like sampling the soil and testing the area's waterways for pollution. Today, Meyer is in a lab at a local college. He's looking through a microscope, counting tiny pieces of plastic, or microplastics, from a sample of creek water.
Okay, I got a pretty sharp view now.
He finds tiny pieces with jagged edges and thin plastic fibers.
Ah, got a thread, and it's pink, so I know it's plastic.
Altogether, Meyer finds dozens of pieces of microplastics in this one small sample of creek water.
I don't know how you get it out. I know how you stop it. You stop using plastic. But that's... we'll be pushing up the daisies before that stops.
It's not all counting plastics in the lab. Some volunteers wade into streams to collect water samples. Others teach kids how to identify aquatic critters. Meyer and fellow volunteer David Schogel say the group is always looking for new members to join.
Anything you're particularly looking for in people who join?
If they're breathing, we want them.
Schogel is 85 and a retired social worker. He sees the nearly three decades he's volunteered with the Senior Environment Corps as part of his legacy.
I'm not a wealthy fellow, and I don't have any money to leave behind to any groups or even my family. But I can leave a better world.
The group meets monthly at a senior center. That's where 74-year-old Eleanor Lundy Wade found out about it. She's a former health inspector and public health educator.
I said, there are seniors that love and do the environment. I said, I want to be one of them.
Fred Lewis helped found the group more than 30 years ago. At 98, he's the oldest member. He says the Corps has been testing water quality for years, but looking for microplastics is new. Lewis is old enough to remember back when plastic first became widely used.
I mean, it was something that was so new that people were just trying to get suggestions as how we can take advantage of it. And now it's how we can end it.
Lewis says some people might assume that the older you get, the less involved with society you become. But he hopes this group changes some minds.
At the count of three.
At the end of every meeting, the volunteers close by singing the Senior Environment Corps song. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Schmidt in Philadelphia.
And testing faithfully. We are tracking down pollution, and we wish we could do more. We are proud to bear the title of the Senior Environment Corps.
Yay! That was a good rendition.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir, presenting their 40th annual holiday concert, a joyous celebration of music and community, December 6th, Paramount Theater in Oakland. More info at oigc.org/holiday. PG&E, if customers see a down power line, stay away from it and keep others away. Call 911. Let first responders come out and handle it. Police and fire will respond as well as PG&E. PGE.com/safety.
On the next Fresh Air, President Trump's strikes on alleged Venezuelan narco-terrorists in boats he claims are transporting drugs. We talk with Washington Post reporter Alex Horton. He broke the story of how the first targeted boat had a second strike intended to kill two survivors in the water, in compliance with Pete Hegseth's order to kill the entire crew. Join us
tonight at 7.
Prices for everything from cars to coffee are soaring, but you can count on some things getting cheaper because they have been for decades. Computers. Storing and processing information has gotten more efficient and more cost-effective over time.
The number of transistors incorporated in a chip will approximately double every 24 months.
But will that last? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
The latest Morning Edition, 2 o'clock until 9 a.m., California Report and KQED News all Thursday morning.
It was a rough year for the Bay Area visual arts scene. Museums lost federal funding and galleries closed, but there were plenty of bright spots, too. I'm arts editor Sarah Hotchkiss, and I wrote about the best art I saw in 2025. Find it online at kqed.org/arts. The KQED Arts and Culture Desk also looks back at the year's best in movies, food, albums, and animals.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. NATO foreign ministers met in Brussels just a day after the last round of U.S.-led peace talks took place in Moscow. There is no evident progress toward ending Russia's full-scale war on Ukraine. Terry Schultz reports that European leaders in both NATO and the European Union are redoubling efforts to provide military backup for both Kyiv and themselves.
Many foreign ministers arriving at NATO headquarters expressed gratitude to President Trump for trying to end the war. Secretary General Mark Rutte went even further.
There is only one person in the whole world who was able to break the deadlock when it comes to the war in Ukraine, and that is the American President Donald J. Trump.
Rutte says he and his team have been kept well informed about the proceedings, but no European representative has been present at the talks. Former Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielis Landsbergis finds that alarming and worse.
It is dangerous and it's humiliating because of what is being discussed is European security.
Landsbergis would like to see Europe stop hoping for an invitation to be by the U.S.'s side.
Instead of Europe begging for a place at the table, Europe should set its own table with a very clear proposals what Europe is going to do to help Ukraine, what measures are going to be used to do that, and what Europe is going to do to help Ukraine win the war.
Estonia's Foreign Minister Margus Sakna echoed those thoughts in Brussels.
We must actually decide what we are going to do in Europe. Putin cannot decide over us. And as well, U.S. Cannot make decisions instead of us.
One big decision Europe's debating is whether to use frozen Russian funds to help Ukraine. Across town from the NATO meeting, the European Commission proposed using about $100 billion worth of these immobilized assets as collateral for a loan to Kyiv, which would be paid back if and when Russia pays reparations for its destruction of Ukraine. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen laid out the legal and moral arguments.
And we can equip them with the means to defend themselves and to lead peace negotiations from a position of strength. And since pressure is the only language the Kremlin responds to, we can also dial it up. We have to increase the costs of war for Putin's aggression, and today's proposal gives us the means to do this.
Many European governments think this is a brilliant idea, a game changer in the struggle to finance Ukraine. But there's one key holdout from the country holding most of the assets. Belgian Foreign Minister Maxime Prévost says the Commission proposal does not adequately share the financial responsibility for what happens should Russia sue and win the right to get the money back.
It is not acceptable to use the money and leave us alone facing the risks. We demand that the risks Belgium is facing as a result of this scheme are fully covered.
Von der Leyen says she believes the new proposal will address all of Belgium's concerns. She hopes to have a deal in hand in 2 weeks when European Union heads of state and government hold their last summit of the year. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Even though the federal government shutdown ended more than 2 weeks ago, some federal employees are still recovering from its effects. They told KNAU reporter Adrian Scabaland about it at a special dinner for them hosted by an organization outside of Grand Canyon National Park.
Ashley Dickerson has worked at Grand Canyon National Park for 3 years.
The federal government shutdown had impacts beyond just getting furloughed for 43 days and missing a couple of paychecks, affecting nearly every facet of her life.
The impacts of stress on your mental health, on your physical health, like on your relationships with family and friends, as they're checking in and trying to figure out, are you going to be moving back home in a month? Because, you know, have they fired you yet? And I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
Diggerson is at Plaza Bonita restaurant in Tucson. It sits just south of the main entrance into the park. She and a couple of dozen other federal workers are enjoying a free meal of fried chicken and tamales, chips and salsa.
This is one way for us to show our support when the community has really been suffering.
Elizabeth Silks is the CEO of Grand Canyon Conservancy. It's the nonprofit partner of the park and is hosting a series of 12 free dinners for residents of Tucson and Grand Canyon Village. Many, but not all, are park employees.
We actually had 250 people at the last dinner, and what it tells us is that people didn't feel very valued who work in the park and the park communities, and a lot of this year has felt very personal.
First came the Trump administration's mass layoffs last spring. Then the shutdown meant about 9,200 National Park Service employees were furloughed. That's according to a Park Service estimate. It's unclear how many of the 500 people who work at Grand Canyon missed paychecks. Plaza Bonita manager Javier Rosas says it's nice to see locals back.
Normally here with us, Thursday was a local day that all locals inside the park used to come with us. And now with this shutdown, there's no more Thursday. So we saw a big difference with that.
Elijah and Wyatt Gibson, who are in 8th and 6th grades respectively, sit in a booth with their mom. Their dad is on the park's trail crew and was furloughed.
He's been spending a lot of days not going to work, and money's been a little tight.
Yeah, the big problem has just mostly been the money, and we've been having a lot of troubles with it.
Their mother, Cassidy Gibson, says even as her husband receives back pay, their family hasn't come out unscathed.
We were able to tap into some savings, but we had to use our credit card more than we'd like. Definitely more than we'd like. So it was hard. You know, that's our livelihood.
For other Grand Canyon workers, the shutdown complicated already stressful situations. Kim Acker, who's worked for the Interior Department for 14 years, had an unexpected medical emergency days after the shutdown began.
I essentially ended up with a large blood clot in my brain. You know, I'm looking at tens of thousands of dollars in medical bills, and it really made me think, can I afford to be missing paychecks if I'm going to have these bills that are due?
Acker says it's left her unsure of her future and whether federal employment is reliable. And she's concerned another shutdown could be looming. The budget resolution only lasts until the end of January.
In another month or two, are we going to be without paychecks again? And to be literally told that we don't matter and that we're not important and that we're low productivity, I mean, why would I want to work for something like that?
Acker says the Grand Canyon Conservancy's events have helped her and others feel more valued, but it still doesn't fully relieve her anxiety about what the future holds. The Conservancy is planning 6 more dinners like this for federal employees and people who live in Tucson and Grand Canyon Village this month. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Scabland in Tucson, Arizona.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters December 12th. Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tools, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. and the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED. Over to KQED traffic, Julie Depish is here with details about something going on in Martinez.
Yeah, we're just getting word of a three-vehicle crash on Highway 4. It's heading westbound at Morello Avenue. Everyone in the center divide, but slow through there anyway because the road work going on at Pine Street. Also, road work in Napa, Highway 29 northbound between 1st Street and Redwood Road. They're working in the right lane until 3 o'clock. Dealing with the hit-run crash San Mateo, northbound 280 is the connector ramp to westbound 92. Car into a tree on the right shoulder. Julie Depish for KQED.
And our afternoon traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meet a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters. Please drink responsibly. You're on KQED 88.5 San Francisco.